Hello listeners, Editor Matt here. Our ongoing series on Zaha Hadid will continue next week with the third episode. But in the meantime, I thought you'd enjoy an unlocked bonus episode from our Patreon feed. The episode you're about to hear was released last year alongside our episode on OMA, Rem Koolhaas's firm, and their projects in the late 80s. In this Patreon bonus, we went on to discuss the theories of bigness that Koolhaas and OMA expounded in more detail. And if you enjoy this bonus content, you can sign up to our Patreon for just $3 a month. And there's a back catalogue now of 30 bonus episodes, extra detail, extra depth to go with all of our main episodes. So, hope you enjoy this unlocked bonus. All the best.
You were joining us for the bonus.
Happy days.
This has been, I'd like to say sort of thanks really for finally getting me to look at this stuff. It's really interesting. I kind of get why you were so excited. I mean, you were really excited by this for a while.
For me, it still totally has integrity.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
It definitely is a thing. Like, I think it's probably naturally slightly less up my street, but it's definitely a real thing.
I mean, Koolhaas is very divisive. Lots of people really hate him. The more like, sort of traditional shading into slightly reactionary
fogies
tendency obviously hate him.
The fogies hate him. But I'm a bit of a fogey and I don't hate him.
Lots of people think he's cynical.
Yeah, I'm not sure I totally buy this like amorality.
Yeah, I don't think he's cynical. But I think that he's found a kind of particular position where he sort of identified the impossible dilemma of being an architect.
Well, he's got a take on it.
Yeah, he
he's
has quite
a
take an
individual on it, which
take
is a
it.
Particular and is a
It's kind of reasoned. I respect it.
It's a reasoned take. It's very difficult because he sits between being dragged along by the coattails of history and the heroic. He's still in the heroic age. That's what he's gunning for. Whereas most people have kind of like slowly the lights of heroism have gone out. Like the oil crisis kind of knocked the real stuffing out of that. Between the Holocaust, Stalin, and like the failure of post-war redevelopment to be very good, the stuffing was knocked out of the future.
Yeah, well, it's going to happen whether we want it to or not, though.
I was listening to David Bowie's Low and reading. I started on the Talking Heads, but it didn't work as well. And I thought there was this long period when kind of cultural production and sort of philosophy and things were just like way out there, and material conditions were. You know, all the pubs, when he was at the AA, all the pubs would close at like 10:30 and they'd be serving like crap beer and people and the students would go home and have like coin operated electricity meters and
It
would be just, everything was really like jellied eels and just
bedsits.
Yeah. Bedsits and cold and rubbish. And there's this sort of effervescent culture. And eventually it feels like the material conditions kind of came up and the culture kind of came down and they sort of met each other. He's one of, not the only one, but one of the people who thought you should just accelerate, be more heroic. The next revolution is coming.
That's a good summation. Yeah, he's sort of an architectural accelerationist, isn't he?
Yeah. An acceleration of architecture was to do with a fundamental acceleration of society as well.
So we're going to talk about Bigness, the essay. One of the things which Bigness says is that in a way the building has to turn inward, and that the integrity of the work is in large part achieved by turning away from the city and becoming about its interior and the possibilities of these very large and complex, fruitfully intense interior conditions.
Yeah, he's trying to make good junk space, the good junk space global collective. But he also genuinely wants it to be good, unlike junk space.
Yeah, it's meant to be good. It's meant to be good. So should we say something about Bigness?
I've listened to it lots and lots of times on a bad text-to-speech algorithm.
It sort of starts off with this observation that architecture becomes something kind of somewhat different once it reaches a certain size. And that certain size is something which is achieved, I mean, most obviously through particular sorts of technological developments. Yeah. So he's got these five theorems of bigness, which come in SMLXL. This is illustrated by a photo of an extremely big naked man.
He's shapely.
No, he's very muscular.
You know, he's got a reasonable coating as well.
He's been hitting the gym.
Yeah, pretty hairless.
So the theorems are as follows. One, beyond a certain critical mass, a building becomes a big building. Such a mass can no longer be controlled by a single architectural gesture, or even by any combination of architectural gestures. This impossibility triggers the autonomy of its parts, but that is not the same as fragmentation. The parts remain committed to the whole.
What's the second one?
Well, it's sort of the art of architecture is useless in bigness, that composition, scale, proportion, detail are moot. They like fade into the background because yeah. It's become so large. The third one is that the distance between core and envelope increases, so that you can no longer have any honesty about the relationship between inside and outside. Yeah, so it can't kind of reveal itself, and that changes its relationship to the city. Big buildings are amoral. They're neither good nor bad. And five, they are no longer part of urban tissue. Its subtext is fuck context.
Above a certain size, buildings have a property which he's describing called bigness. Bigness cannot be contained by architectural gestures. Now, well, actually, perhaps we should just go through them in turn and describe what they are. So one again.
Beyond a certain critical mass, a building becomes a big building. Such a mass can no longer be controlled by a single architectural gesture or even by any combination of architectural gestures. This impossibility triggers the autonomy of its parts, but that is not the same as fragmentation. The parts remain committed to the whole.
So what does that mean? That sounds... Okay, so the first idea that big things are different, that makes sense.
I think that they can no longer be legible and that they can no longer have that sort of diagrammatic clarity.
I don't totally get what he means. That things are a bit different when they're big. There's several different things going on. There's things that feel big, which don't actually have to be that big. Like, I suspect if you're at the bottom of the Burj Khalifa, it doesn't feel any bigger than being at the bottom of other things. It sort of tapers away. And
whereas, like, Westfield Shopping Centre, there's a bigness to, like, yeah. Big shopping centres, for example, which is that it has, like, three car parks which are attached to it, and it has all of these different... It has lots of different repeated bits which are identical and all sorts of other arbitrary bits which are different, and then it has a relationship between all of them.
But that's about complexity, not scale, really. You could have a building which is a massive aircraft hangar. It's got the full scale. Or like the building that they assemble the Saturn V rocket in.
Fine, but mega big. But they're actually not really inhabitable by people.
Okay, well, what about... Like, one of those towers in the city is a huge glass tower. All the floors are basically the same. You can see into them all. They're all office, and it's defined by a shape.
Sure, yeah. But actually, the relationship between the floors of, like, an office tower starts to become really strange, because you have...
Well, the relationship is a lift.
Yeah, but from floor to floor, if you ever, like, get off on the wrong floor of one of these places. Actually, that's one of the things that he talks about in Delirious New York as a kind of lobotomy, that each one is completely...
They're autonomous,
unaware,
yeah.
of the last one, of the previous one.
But what does he mean it can't be defined by a single architectural gesture or a group of architectural gestures?
I don't know, because that's a bit elusive, isn't it? What is the
gesture? Don't know what it means. Because, like, you can put a big building inside a shape, which is an architectural gesture. That seems to have been... There's a whole strain of architecture which is basically doing that.
A gesture can always be big enough, can't it?
Yeah. You can just make it into... I mean, that was like the architecture of the noughties, wasn't it? 90s and noughties.
But I think that it's about how controlled it is, so that the gesture may well be there, but it's subject to a kind of radioactive decay, isn't it? It's like slightly falling apart at the edges.
Expand that.
Gesture is sort of self-undermining, like its bigness becomes crude and becomes undermined by the way that it, like, gets separated into lots of bits or whatever.
Like, becomes not architectural, it becomes sculptural. Because if you're just filling... If you're creating a shape and filling it with offices or houses offices or apartments or whatever.
Yeah.
The apartments and the offices don't really have any connection to the shape. They're just inhabiting it because the unit of the room is so small that you can, they're just pixels in a form.
Yeah, sure.
In the way that, like, a courtyard or a corridor or an enfilade, you know, a progression of rooms linked onto each other, or those things are architectural organizational things which you don't have in very big buildings. In very big buildings you have like network of connections where you have big connections and small connections and
Absolutely. Well, I think that that goes on to the next, maybe I'll do the next two because I think they're connected. Number two is the elevator with its potential to establish mechanical rather than architectural connections and its family of related inventions render null and void the classical repertoire of architecture. Issues of composition, scale, proportion, detail are now moot. The art of architecture is useless in bigness. And then three, in bigness, the distance between core and envelope increases to the point where the facade can no longer reveal what happens inside. The humanist expectation of honesty is doomed. Interior and exterior architectures become separate projects, one dealing with the instability of programmatic and iconographic needs, the other, agent of disinformation, offering the city the apparent stability of an object. Where architecture reveals, bigness perplexes. Bigness transforms the city from a summation of certainties into an accumulation of mysteries. What you see is no longer what you get.
So this seems to me about deep plan and deep section. So when a building is very deep, you're not near a window. Like if it's more than 5 meters deep, you've kind of got to start lighting and things. And the network of technologies are forced air, lighting, and lifts that transport you. And deep serviced buildings, right? Which is sort of true, except that one desperately tries to not be in a position where one is forced by work or life to spend very much time, except like inside a theatre or something like that, in one of the spaces that is deep in the plan.
Yeah.
Like people congregate near the edges because the rest of it's horrid.
Definitely. But I think that the idea that the exterior and the interior become fundamentally quite separate from each other. I mean, I think that's already what we were talking about. So the exterior becomes defined by these big iconographic gestures, you know, making the walkie-talkie or whatever. And then the interior becomes often an exercise carried out by a completely different firm.
But I would say quite often they're like corals in that there's a kind of dead core, which is literally concrete, lifts, toilets and things. And then there's this thin skin of inhabitable tissue on the outside. Like I'm thinking of the towers in the city. All the flats, the kind of grammar is like basically glass curtain, possibly with not. You can see in, you can see out, you can see the different activities of all the floors, all the people's like kids' post-it notes on their windows, like tiny, in this kind of flesh.
Yeah.
This sort of 4, 5 meters, 6 meters of inhabitable space. And then the deep plan is holding the building up and moving people around and vacated. And I think with most building types, if you expand the plan, there's nothing you can put in the middle.
I mean, in the city, they want it because people want to have these enormous single-plan offices, don't they? Like trading floors or whatever it is that they want it
for. Yeah, but even they're not that big. I've been in a couple.
That supposedly is the rationale for building the walkie-talkie.
That's a stunningly ugly building, that one. It's also, due to the viewing corridors, they will not be able to build any round it, so it's just going to be like that.
Forever.
I mean, they can put them behind it, but...
Yeah.
I think that's just gross. I don't think there's any justification for it.
No. I'm sure they can.
You can't put trading floors high up in towers, really, because they need a huge, clear, open space, which actually needs to be... which has got higher loading criteria, apart from anything else.
Mm.
You have to reinforce the floors.
Yeah, what? Because you're taking columns out.
You take all the columns out and you put loads of heavy stuff on it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's right. But I think he's talking about a really specific sort of buildings. It's a really specific sort of multi-purpose shopping mall, airport, cinema, cultural complex, infrastructure or cultural infrastructure.
Yeah, they become kind of infrastructural, or they become a little bit like megastructures, but without the rhetoric or without the sort of uniformity.
Megastructures are big buildings. I think he regards them as a funny thing because they're kind of megastructures are explicitly repeating units rather than a skyscraper.
Sure.
is like an object with stuff in it. Yeah. A megastructure is like
the landscape,
an kind extension of a landscape.
So then the last two are short, and they are: through size alone, such buildings enter an amoral domain beyond good or bad. Their impact is independent of their quality. And five is: together, all these breaks with scale, with architectural composition, with tradition, with transparency, with ethics, imply the final, most radical break. Bigness is no longer part of any urban tissue. It exists at most. It coexists. Its subtext is fuck context.
He's really describing a shopping centre.
Yeah,
kind possibly of. An airport with a shopping centre and a hotel on top. Like, yeah. That's really what's being described here. Because even a skyscraper really does exist in urban context.
Yeah, although increasingly its urban context is sort of part of the building, isn't it? You know, it's a sort of ersatz public space, which is...
Oh, sure, it might have a crappy plaza outside the front. But yeah. Also, I don't know about American ones. I've never been to America. I know about big towers here, which I can't believe are that fundamentally different.
No, I'm sure they're pretty similar. Yeah.
Which is, you go into a big lobby and then you go up a lift and there's like a range of different lifts. One will take you to the restaurant on the top, which has probably got a different door to it. One will have there'll be a lobby with a big fish tank or some massive marble screen or something and some very impressive looking people in suits and some blipper things. And then you'll go up. And in a way, you actually have quite an immediate relationship with the street in each office because you're just really a lift ride away.
Mm-hmm.
Doors ping open, and you can immediately see outside. And you are actually, the inhabitants of the building have a relationship with the city. They can see out the other buildings. It's not like a shopping centre. It's not like Westfield where you kind of arrive in some basement metro station, go up three flights of stairs into an enormous concourse, which you then go through loads of things, up a flight of stairs into another shop.
Yeah.
The skyscrapers aren't like that. I think what he's describing is a massive deep building with a mixed program. Yeah. Which I don't think is necessarily exclusively to do with scale. I think it's to do with program. And he loves the density and excitement of lots of things happening together. You know, you can imagine like some Jakarta street where like people are doing trading and sleeping and putting up scaffolding and things at one level. And you can imagine all of these sort of activities occurring together in a place with all these exciting people in a very dense urban way. But actually, most big buildings aren't really like that at all. Most big buildings are separations. Yeah. And the way they create density is they create density in the city by having lots of people in the same place. They kind of create a lot of density at the street. It creates a density and excitement in the urban realm because there's all this stuff together.
Yeah.
But that actually exists in the city, not in the building.
Yeah.
For the most part.
He, in a way, he's talking about actually existing bigness. Again, this is another retroactive manifesto, I think, and he's very much aiming it at...
This also does describe his buildings. It describes a shopping centre, and it describes his buildings, except that his buildings are contained within architectural gestures, and architecture is important.
Well, there's a couple of different things to unpack there. So one is that, yeah, I mean, later on, he essentially comes out and says, like, we shouldn't think about detail, like... Detail's sort of not really possible.
Yeah, he doesn't.
There's a certain,
he thinks about it occasionally, but they're not that strong on it.
And that at a certain scale, it's not really possible to worry about these kind of things, and it's better just not to.
I'm not sure that's true. You can just use the same details over and over again.
Yeah.
And then modify them as appropriate.
Yeah.
I think that's, I think lots of the things he says are not true.
I mean, a bit that, like, there's a sort of junk spatial logic to the life of these spaces as well. So, like, it's not worth sweating the details too much because they have their own kind of chaotic development.
It's an interesting essay, but I think it muddles up propositional commentary and manifest and like, this is how it must be. I mean, the statements about how things are aren't particularly true of what they're describing in abstract. They're true of very specific situations.
Yeah, I think so he has a critique of basically of all of these different, you know, mega structural or other ways of understanding how you could or should approach large buildings, and he addresses in turn high tech, structuralism, basically those two.
But the way large buildings are designed generally is on a commercial basis.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's kind of what he's describing. Oh, here. Yeah. So he talks about the Beaubourg Centre, which he calls a platonic loft. It proposes spaces where anything is possible. But the resulting flexibility was unmasked as the imposition of a theoretical average at the expense of both character and precision, entity at the price of identity.
You can have a position that a venue for art doesn't need to have identity. Like the box on the outside, the building has very strong identity, but the rooms can just be galleries.
Yeah, But you actually, you say that as if like a gallery was a generic thing, but it's not. It's a specific space. And actually, they generally work better if they have specific qualities, but which are adaptable to different sorts of purposes. I mean, actually, I think generic galleries, if you think of the, like, the new British Museum galleries, which are like generic spaces, they're very ineffective. Whereas,
I mean, I don't think that one's really bad, but it's
not great, is it? People talk about the white cube, but actually, the sorts of spaces which people really like to display art in are ones which have quite particular spatial qualities. And that, yeah, basically he kind of has this critique. So yeah, on the one hand, of that kind of idea that what big buildings should do is to offer a sort of generic wrapper which can be filled with whatever. I don't know how many quotes to do, but I think that his prose is one of the things which is really interesting in the essay, yeah. Which is that is this, he has a very particular style of kind of rhetorical. I don't know, it has like
it's
a real...
Not like, it's like the book in general, it's not super penetrable. It's erudite and jokey.
Yeah.
Like at the same time, you kind of have to both know a lot to understand what he's saying, and you also kind of just have to take a lot of it on faith.
So here's one. So this one basically describes the kind of structuralist approach of having lots of little modules which kind of accumulate into a large landscape. He says, in the first, the world is decomposed into incompatible fractals of uniqueness, each a pretext for further disintegration of the whole, a paroxysm of fragmentation that breaks the particular into a system. Behind this breakdown of program, according to the smallest functional particles, looms the perversely unconscious revenge of the old form follows function doctrine that drives the content of the project. Behind fireworks of intellectual and formal sophistication, relentlessly towards the anticlimax of diagram, doubly disappointing since its aesthetic suggests the rich orchestration of chaos. In this landscape of dismemberment and phony disorder, each activity is put in its place. So, I mean, what he's critiquing there is the fact that these buildings present an image of, like, organicity,
yeah,
which is actually very highly staged,
yeah, so extremely this would be like organized. Runity.
At one level, that's absolutely true. At another level, on to go beyond that, it's then been able to accommodate a large amount of disorder in its subsequent yeah. life, which
I mean,
actually gives it its charm.
I would say the designs of his buildings are kind of like that as well. It's just that they're not crystalline, they're not lots of small things, but they are diagrams which generate complexity or the appearance of complexity by sort of making complicated a diagram. That's sort of his shtick. It doesn't have the element that it doesn't have repeating units, but that's because of the program. If it was full of flats, it would have to have repeating units because...
I think that he does identify, though, like a real tension in those, which is that on the one hand, you have the appearance of complexity and disorder, and on the other hand, you have the clarity and organisation of diagram. And so there's an inherent kind of contradiction. Yeah, no, I mean, the critique of those more orthodox megastructures is that they attempt to sort of disappear, but that, like, actually what that does is sort of imposes a kind of blandness.
Yeah, they're less interesting than, like, the street in the sky and the Barbican is less interesting than just a street. I mean, in some ways, actually, it's more interesting because it's big and singular and architecturally powerful. But once you've decided you don't like those things, it's much less interesting because it is all the same. I think this whole thing is more interesting as a proposal for a type of thing. It works as an apology for the design of his buildings, of this design of those competitions.
The question which is being pointed at is the question of urban architecture, or architecture which establishes the identity of the city within, like, the sort of urban heart. And what he's saying, which is polemical, is that that's not a meaningful thing to pursue, actually.
Yeah, whatever. Like, I think that's fine as long as it justifies him doing something. I don't think architects should tell other architects what they can't do. Because obviously you can, actually. Obviously, like, it is an endeavour that's meaningful. And I think generally, architectural prescriptions which say you mustn't do all this stuff, it's pointless, it's just stupid. In the context of the essay, it's kind of fun. Yeah. It's a good read. I don't think that's got any intellectual rigour saying that. I think that's sort of silly.
Saying what in particular?
Saying that engaging in trying to do urban architecture that functions within a big city core is meaningless.
Well, I think it's a very, like, Rotterdam view, isn't it?
I think it's silly. I think it's a silly thing to say. It's a massive sweeping generalisation saying that something is impossible, which is clearly possible.
Yeah, I guess it's also sort of in dialogue with, or with a kind of protracted theoretical discussion about, you know, how to do architecture, or how to do architecture in like an autonomous way in the context of a city that seems to have its own.
Yeah, yeah, sure. I mean, that's quite right.
Agenda.
You can say all of these other things are sort of nonsense, and that'll often be true. The trump card for doing architecture in any situation is that you can actually just do it. Which is kind of like a... You don't need to theoretically justify architecture. Architecture is justified by utility, by utility and delight.
Yeah, or just existing, I guess. He's definitely... I mean, he has a very distinct style, which I've always really liked. I like his essays. It's very hyperbolic, but then also seems to like slightly step back from itself.
They're like a combination of like brilliantly written like colour pieces for environments. He's like writing colour pieces for his sort of vision of...
Yeah.
Well, when I say colour piece, I mean like the thing that's not the story, but with bits of architectural proposition or comment in it.
Yeah.
Like Junk Space is really a colour piece, isn't it? It's this great description of walking through an airport, really, about what if this airport went on forever? What if there was nothing but this airport? Something we've all thought, you know, and in a sense it does, yeah. And it's a sort of musing on that in a kind of, as an essay. But it then says it's sort of a universal description of architecture, which is not, they're not that actually. What they are these musings on environment.
Yeah. And it's interesting that, so late career, Rem Koolhaas, his thing which he's doing now is that he's completely broken away from the city and he's doing this long research project on the countryside.
Yeah, preservation in the countryside. He's been doing it for like 10 years or something, hasn't he?
Yeah, and I think it's going to be at MoMA, like it's like, or somewhere. It's booked in for this big exhibition. It'll be interesting to see how it works out. Should we talk a bit about SMLXL? The book, I think, is almost the most 90s piece of design I think you can really imagine. It has, you know, the sort of distinct graphic and sort of design.
It's got a lot of graphic design in it. It's not soft touch, the graphic design.
Well, first of all, there's the organisation of it, which is that the projects are not done by date or by theme or anything, but in order of size.
Yeah, which kind of does actually organise them by date a bit.
Yeah, which is kind of, I mean, and it works. It's a nice idea. They're just like radically incompatible and different like graphic designs for different bits, which are just layered, different fonts, different colours. No one matters. Like, you'll go from, you know, like pages and pages of full bleed photos of models into bits which are just...
Which will often have things superimposed on top of them.
Yeah, into bits which are just plans with no explanation, or like just sketches without telling you what they are, or like random bits of Japanese pornography.
Stories, descriptions of his dreams.
But then also running through it, it has a dictionary, which is a sort of special dictionary of all sorts of words, which are actually all quotations.
Often quotations from him. To be fair.
Well, not often. Like, a few of them are. Visibility 1 is a sort of famous story about Guy de Maupassant lunching at the Eiffel Tower because it was the only place you couldn't see it from.
Yeah, yeah. Lots of sort of and little bits of anecdotes, basically. Yeah, like, but without any clue to what they are.
There's a key at the end which tells you where they're all from. But you
have to schlep it around to look it up. Which you rather liked as a joke, that you'd look it up and discover it was nothing in particular. It's not a good way of describing projects to make you work out what they're about. It's about producing this book, which is a kind of product of his worldview.
It's the novel about architecture. And it is a real... It's kind of a work of art. I mean, it's quite an amazing...
It starts with all these, like, really 90s graphs, which are like 3D graphs projected over photographs of his office, which chart, like, how many air miles he's done over time, how much, you know, income and expenditure. And you can kind of, if you look at it, analyse it finally, you can work out that his office has gone bankrupt.
Yeah. which it had at this point. Is that the story?
This was released at a time where, in fact, this was released just after it had gone insolvent and been taken over.
Bigness is typeset in SMLXL in text, which starts off at like size
very big.
48 or something.
And it goes all the way down to size... medium. It's quite big,
still
actually.
Quite large, yeah.
can you remember how you found it when you first got it and what how it felt?
Well, completely, it's incomprehensible. Yeah. Because even actually to start off just understanding where the projects are particularly. But I did really engage with it. I really found it very interesting, and I've gone back to it a lot of times. I think I got very into Très Grande Bibliothèque. That one is quite accessible.
I found working out what it was from the project really, from there, really hard. I just looked up other pictures of it.
I got that. Or Zeebrugge Ferry Terminal, I think it's quite a good one. I've forgotten in this that the diagram at the beginning of the Bruegel painting upside down is painted in silver, like silver ink.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of quite loose graphics.
TGB has got a diary running all the way through it.
Yes, yes. Oh, lots of them do, actually. Dear diary, I tried to be very good today. I tried to be very obedient.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I mean, I don't have a very good memory for how I felt at different times
in my
life.
You were super excited. You had right at the beginning, you had a real interest. You were really excited by him.
Mm.
I remember it was like prior to the Ruskin phase. There was a real REM phase.
Yeah, I think there were projects which I think I've looked at a lot of times. I think these big ones I have been looking at for a long time. I mean, I also like slightly ripped off his weird drawing style from the student days and things.
Yeah, yeah, and a bit of the you got design mentality of like the objects sort of and the kind of like funny structural grids interceding and like.
Oh, it has a terrible comic in it.
Yeah, is that by Sun?
Apologies to Thomas Kuhlhaas, who I think...
Oh, Thomas, yeah.
Who I think has a different career now.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of, like, self-justification and, like, embittered things going awry. I think SMLXL was only possible because the business had failed and he couldn't do anything else. Yeah. Like, I think he must have seen that, like, this is going to go. Time to put some energy into something else.
Yeah.
Raise the profile. I mean, in there, he quite early on in SMLXL, he says, I had the problem that Delirious New York had made me really famous, but my office didn't actually exist. And this is sort of like, the office is ceasing to exist. I better make myself famous again.
Well, and it worked. I mean, it's a landmark of architectural publishing. He's kind of always interested or seems to be kind of gesturing towards the impossibility of doing architecture or something like that. So when he did Venice Biennale, for example, he essentially did it all about specification. It's called The Elements of Architecture. And it's essentially the provocation is that people don't really design buildings anymore. They just pick lots of things out of the catalogue, which is actually much closer to the truth than you would generally discern from the outside. Like that so much of the business of making a building happen is actually finding a series of available products which are possible to use.
Except at the really, really high end. But the really, really high end is kind of the buildings he does and is interested in. So they've always been at the really, really high end. Yeah. He hasn't worked at any other. He's done like really expensive houses, theatres, cultural institutions, stadiums, lots of stuff for Prada.
The office is obviously very big now and does lots of work, but I think that he's been quite sort of selectively involved in projects for a long time. They have lots and lots of partners who...
And something that's in SMLXL is a very specific accreditation of which team is in which project. And if you go on their office website, you can sort by team members, the projects they're involved in. Because the myth of the architect is nonsense. It's a really important tool for branding.
Yes, here's another great... building by me.
I drew something on the back of a napkin and it turned into brilliance. There's a meeting with the client and the client is a big ego man. He's a genius, but a genius in another field. And then the genius architect talked to him. He explained his impossible problem. And then the genius on the back of a napkin architect drew a funny shape. And that was the inspiration of the build.
But normally what happens is that the team design the building for them and then they do the sketch. At the end.
The story of justified inspiration is so funny because it's the other way around. Like, you have an unlimited supply of inspiration and ideas, making the funny things work, that's the problem. Ideas aren't hard to come up with. Tons of them about.
Yeah, the world's lousy with them.
Well, this has been a nice bit of fun.
Yes, thanks a lot for listening. Thanks for subscribing.
Yeah, we'll do more of this in the future, but not... the immediate future. We've got a whole load of different stuff lined up, actually. We're going to go back to the 19th century. We're going to go forward into the future. We're going to go out into horror.
We're going to go to all sorts of exciting places. So, thank you.
Thank you all.
Until next time.
I really think we're going somewhere.
Yeah.
We're going to make this podcast great.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Good night.